Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Sam Karp, Vice President of Programs at the California Healthcare Foundation. This program is underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation, found on the web at chcf.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Matt Miller, contributing editor to Fortune Magazine, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and author of The Tyranny of Dead Ideas and The 2% Solution. In the wake of President Obama's call for change, Miller proposes new ideas for healthcare and other sectors that he believes will ensure a safe and secure future for all Americans. As a longtime advocate for reevaluating our government's foundation, Miller's reassessment of entrenched political conventions challenges the traditional wisdom of politicians. Miller outlines ways to combat these, quote, dead ideas and overcome the impediments to the ultimate goal of an accessible, affordable American healthcare system. Please join me in welcoming Matt Miller.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And I really apologize for being late. I know this was called for 12. I live in Los Angeles, and we were sitting on the tarmac for about an hour in L.A. with some kind of engine repair and then some kind of San Francisco weather. So there was nothing I could do. But I will say that if I thought I was under-caffeinated before this morning, the hair-raising taxi drive from the airport to here, where the guy did a fabulous job of sort of shrinking what's usually about 25 minutes into about 12, was enough to wake anyone up. So thank you for your understanding, and thanks for your wonderful introduction. I'm delighted to be in San Francisco. You know, as I said, I'm from L.A., but I've always had this nagging feeling that that maybe I belonged in San Francisco. That was my California destiny, not L.A. I'm an East Coast kid originally, so when we came out here about 13 years ago, there were choices. And we do love L.A., but whenever I'm in San Francisco, I am grateful for the views and the vistas and the romance and Tony Bennett. So I applaud you just for being San Franciscans. I also want to applaud the California Healthcare Foundation and Mark Smith, who couldn't be here today, who does such great work in healthcare and has been an inspiration to me in my own thinking and rethinking of some of our healthcare challenges, and to the Commonwealth Club itself, because this tradition of civic dialogue and civic engagement is needed, as you know, and may never have been more needed than at the current surreal moment we are going through. Now, we're meeting at a kind of auspicious time. The economy is in very difficult straits, and yet I have a feeling that as fellow Californians, you share my optimism that we will get through this, no matter how daunting the challenges may seem. We know this because even in California, where the state budget is a mess, where we are arguably ungovernable, if you think about the proposition madness, at least as I've become obsessed in my decade or so of living here, when you've got the state government now saying it was going to talk about sending out scripts instead of tax refunds as a kind of, you know, the new voucher economy we're going to have here. So we've obviously got challenges ourselves, but we will get through this, just like we've gotten through things before. And I think there's something about the California disposition. Maybe it's the weather, maybe it's the views, maybe it's the Pacific air that sort of keeps us cheerful even in the face of these challenges. My wife, in my own case, thinks this is a high serotonin issue, but I know that we'll be able to get through this. Let me, I think I'm still going to speak for, I should speak about half an hour, I think, as my keepers have suggested. I want to talk today about dead ideas, which I view as an eternal and really human phenomena that's universal, that plagues all of us. It's the result of an essential vulnerability in human nature and human psychology. It's our slowness in updating the way we think about the world when the world itself radically changes. So what we're going to talk about is the trouble we get into when we cling to the things we think we know. Now, I think dead ideas, the whole idea of dead ideas, is really what got us into this ditch in the economy. You know, we've seen in the last 6 months the implosion of the dead idea that financial markets can regulate themselves. Now, if we had uncovered and unearthed and gotten ahead of that wrong way of thinking 5 or 6 years ago, we could have avoided enormous damage and human pain and suffering that we're now going through, but we didn't. Even Alan Greenspan now admits, and he may have been the chief apostle of that dead idea, that he was wrong about the ability of financial markets to self-regulate and the incentives facing senior executives in the banking industry to make sure that they didn't put at risk their institutions and therefore the country, but that turned out to be wrong. I think similarly, if we don't get out front of the dead ideas that are at the heart of my book, we will not find our way back to a durable prosperity. And the good news is we can. It just requires opening our eyes and collectively being open to new ways of thinking and to unearthing outmoded, antiquated habits of mind that are now holding us back. Now, the dead ideas I'm going to talk about today focus obviously on our public life and on our economic life, but I think the whole notion of dead ideas applies really to our business life or professional life. If you work in an organization, you know that calcified ways of doing things always build up in an institution, and then things radically change, circumstances change, and it's very difficult to adapt, for leaders to adapt, for different parts of the organization to adapt. So it certainly applies in our organizational life. I think dead ideas applies in our personal life as well. In our relationships, if anyone else here is married and has been married for some time, you know that dead ideas can even rear their head in marriages. So I guess I want to suggest that we're prey to these dead ideas in every aspect of our life and at every level of society. And I'd like to persuade you in our time together that when it comes to our economic life, we're in the grip of some very big dead ideas that are holding us back, but that you can overcome them as individuals, that we can overcome them as a nation. And when we do overcome them, your life will be better, our country will be better, you'll probably lose weight and look better than you have in years. I can't overstate the power of overcoming these dead ideas. Your friends will notice, strangers will admire you, you'll radiate a certain exuberance and charm. So I want you to think of The Tyranny of Dead Ideas as a self-help book that's disguised in part as a book that's out to change the way you think about politics and the economy, because in all seriousness, I think the battle to save our economy and our future really does start inside our heads. So what are dead ideas? Which ones are tyrannizing us, and how do we break free? Dead ideas is the phrase I use to describe old ways of thinking that that we cling to, even though circumstances radically change. Conventional wisdoms that retain their power over us long after it makes any sense to hold on to them, or beliefs that, while comforting, and we all know they're comforting beliefs, are so at odds with reality that they amount to delusions that hold us back and may even, in some cases, doom us to fail. The story I tell about dead ideas starts with some grim realities, because the situation we're in today is grim. But it ends with enormous hope, so long as each of us is willing to open our minds and committing to moving past old ways of thinking that no longer make sense, and, as importantly, to making the world safe for our political leaders and our business leaders to do the same. Because that's the way democracy works. We need to be a constituency for the kind of change that we want, and only if groups of citizens signal their willingness to think in new ways do politicians and political leaders feel it's safe to step outside the old conventional boxes. Now, not everyone thinks dead ideas are as dangerous as I do, of course. I had the chance to do the Colbert Report the other night when we launched the book, and he's very funny, as you know. One of the dead ideas we'll talk about today is that taxes hurt the economy and they're always too high, and when he said on the show, "So what's your next dead idea?" I said, "Taxes hurt the economy and they're always too high." He says, "Right, what's the dead idea?" It's very funny, actually, when you do that show, there's a little person who comes to you in the green room where you're waiting before you do the show. And after Stephen Colbert has said, you know, he says hello as a real person and then says, look, here's the drill. He goes, I play a character. That character is an idiot. Your job is to disabuse that character of his ignorance, no matter what he's throwing at you, and just have fun, which is what we tried to do. Then this little person comes in and says, you know, the writers, this is about 5 minutes before you go on the air, he goes, the writers for the show, and there's a team of apparently a dozen writers, have brainstormed some questions to give Stephen that he might ask you, you know, and we don't want the first time you hear these things to be right when you're in the seat next to him, so he may not use this stuff, and it turned out he didn't, but we just wanted to give you an idea of what they've put in front of him. So this is to have fun with the idea of the tyranny of dead ideas. So the first question was, why should we get rid of the old ideas when the new ideas suck? The second question, which wasn't used but cracked us up in the green room, was, even if the old ideas don't work anymore, shouldn't we still practice them out of a sense of tradition? And now, I think the answer to that question is no, and I would like to persuade you that the answer to that is no. So let me suggest how I frame this in the book. I think we're in a moment that's like 1928. If you had asked ordinary Americans in 1928, should the federal government have a role in assuring against poverty and old age? Should the federal government have a role in trying to intervene, to mitigate against economic downturns, or to help people who lost their jobs, tide them and their families over until they got traction and new employment? In 1928, most Americans would have said no. We were a nation of rugged individualists. These were matters for the family circle or for local private charities, but not for the federal government. By 1940, those propositions were considered common sense. The climate of opinion had been transformed by events. Now, we're not going to have another Great Depression. I am convinced that we are throwing lots of spaghetti against the wall. We've done so before. We've got two new major spaghetti-throwing efforts underway with a smart crew under the Obama administration. So I don't believe we're going to have anything like what we saw in the 1930s. But nonetheless, the current crisis we're in the midst of and the continued acceleration of globalization and of rapid technological change at this point in our economic history have nonetheless brought us to the cusp, I think, of a similar revolution in ideas, in the way we think about our economic life, and that means everything from the role of government to the role of corporations to the way we view the power of the individual to shape his economic destiny in a global age. So we are at that moment where the pressure of events is going to force a fresh rethinking, and the stakes at this moment are very high because I think circumstances are building where in the next decade we're going to have forces at work that pose real risk to the middle class and to the traditional political and business arrangements on which our prosperity has rested for decades. These are forces that build on and go beyond just the current economic crisis, but have to do with the rise of China and India and other developing economies, and the fact that we've lost our kind of unique post-World War II predominance in the world economically. The stakes are high, I believe, because I think that if wealthy nations, the U.S. and other wealthy nations, lose faith in capitalism's ability to improve the lives of ordinary Americans, then the efforts by the rich world to protect its citizens against economic change will not only end up hurting ourselves, but also doom the developing world to dollar-a-day poverty. So the stakes are very high. Now, I think the good news is there's no reason we can't avert these dark scenarios and flourish. The bad news is that we're not doing what we need to because what I call in the book the tyranny of dead ideas. Now, what I do in the book is lay out an immutable three-step process by which you can identify and unearth and uncover and transcend these dead ideas. This is something that's perfectly safe to try at home. You can use it in your organizational or professional life or even in your marriage, as some people have already told me they've been trying to do with the mixed degrees of books being tossed across the room, apparently. But by way of sharing the core ideas in the book, walk you through this three-step process. The first step in getting past dead ideas is straightforward enough. It's to identify the dead ideas that matter. Now, obviously, at any time in our public life, there are dozens of dead ideas we could focus on. In our personal and professional lives, there may be hundreds or more. But I think that at any time, if you think about history, there's only a handful that really have the ability to have major consequences for a society. but they are littered throughout our history. So, for example, up to the middle of the 19th century, it was considered perfectly reasonable for large chunks of the United States to believe that an economy based on white human beings owning black human beings was moral and sustainable. Now, obviously, this is grotesque and preposterous to us now, but back then it shaped the contours of countless lives. Up until 1920, it was reasonable in large chunks of the United States to believe that democracy did not require extension of the vote to women. Again, this seems crazy to us now, but it colored the texture of our society. Now, the dead ideas that I'm talking about at the heart of the book, and there'll be six that I focus on, may not have quite the moral urgency of slavery or suffrage, but I want to suggest that for American society today in 2009, and the expectations we have and have built for ourselves and our country's trajectory and our future and our children's future, the consequences of failing to blow up these dead ideas and move toward a set of new ideas that need to replace them is grave and poses real risks to us if we don't step up. Now, let me tick through, and we can cover in the question and answer period, we can cover the more details that you may want to have on each of the dead ideas, but let me tick through them so you have a good overview of what I'm talking about. By the way, this I hope this won't diminish your appetite for reading the book, because I won't be able to do justice here to the thrilling historical narrative and the you know, the exciting prose, the accessible economics. So I do hope you'll still want to read the book, or at least buy it, which is what my publisher says is all any author can really ask. So here's the six dead ideas I focus on. The first is what I call the kids will earn more than we do. And by that, I refer to the American creed, really, of upward mobility that's basically been baked into our national character since its founding, right? Our founders fled England to get away from a class-based, rigid, aristocratically controlled society. And from the very beginning, with our founding ideal that all men were created equal, the idea of the ability of an individual American to rise by virtue of his own grit and hard work and determination, whether it's in public icons like Benjamin Franklin or Abraham Lincoln, obviously, from Log Cabin to the White House, to our literature and culture, the Horatio Alger novels, the Rags to Riches novels in the 19th century, literary strivers like Jay Gatsby in the 20th century, the whole idea that in America you can make your life what you want it to be through hard work and determination is the essence of the American ideal, and yet that is beginning to collide with new research that shows that up to 100 million Americans live in families today that are earning less than their parents did at a similar age. And this is before we face the full impact of economic integration with rising countries like China and India. So these trends are likely only to deepen. Now, obviously, the idea that our faith in the ever-rising tide has done enormously beneficial things for the American character. We're the can-do nation, the nation of entrepreneurs and inventors who build new technologies, who help win two world wars, put a man on the moon. All that is enormously positive. But I'd like to suggest that our faith that things will always be better for the next generation has given us a few blind spots in our national mindset that are problematic at our current crossroads. The first of these is that I think we have, because of our faith in the ever-rising tide, we have overestimated the power of the individual to shape his or her economic destiny. You know, the thought has been in America that there's so much opportunity for the taking that if you can't make it in America, it's your fault. That sentiment has colored debates from the welfare reform debate in the 90s to various immigration debates all through our history. But we're in a situation now where even many hardworking Americans, because of the global economic forces I'm talking about, may have a harder time getting traction on this this ladder of upward mobility in which we've always had faith. And I think acknowledging the idea that we have overestimated the power of the individual to shape his economic destiny will lead us to rebalance our sense of what the role ought to be of the individual and the community through government in assuring opportunity and security for a wealthy nation like the United States. I think in a similar fashion, our faith in the ever-rising tide is partly what's fueled the mentality that's led us to a kind of debt-addicted consumption at all levels of society, because we figure we're going to do better in the future. We'll figure out a way to, you know, raise our incomes and pay our way out of this. And that's affected everything from consumer incomes to government behaviors and enormous unfunded promises we have there as well. So the first debt idea is what I call the kids will earn more than we do. The second debt idea is that free trade is good no matter how many people it hurts. Now, I'm not a protectionist, so I don't think the answer is protection. But what I focus on with this debt idea is the point that I believe that economists in both political parties have hyped the case for free trade for political reasons and have poo-pooed in ways that are wrong and actually undermining of their own goals, but have poo-pooed the impact on rising millions of Americans who we know are affected by trade and are hurt by trade. And the answer, I believe, is not protection, as I said, but it's a new set of protections that make sure that when it comes to health care, when it comes to pension security, when it comes to unemployment assistance, when it comes to retraining, that we build in a more robust set of protections so that we, in the long term, can maintain a consensus for freer markets and open trade that benefit nations in the long term, but which any honest assessment shows hurts millions of people in the near term. And I think that economists, what I try and show is that they have gone beyond what economic science can actually claim in the statements they make about free trade's benefits, and that they're doing this because they view themselves, and this is irregardless of what political party the economist happens to be in or whose ears they're whispering in, they do this because, to see their point of view, they worry that that if we talk too much about those who are hurt by trade, those arguments will be used by the barbarians who want to raise protectionist walls, and that will spiral down into a repeat of what we saw in the 1930s, and that will hurt everyone. But I think it's no, what I say to the economists is it's no mystery to people who are losing from trade that they're losing. And there's already a backlash brewing against trade, if you can see even in the Buy American provisions that are put into the current stimulus package. This is happening in all the wealthy nations. And unless economists get out front and stop trying to pretend what we, what we know is the case isn't the case, the case for markets and trade, which does help us in the long term, will only be diminished. The third debt idea is what I call your company should take care of you. And by that, I refer to the unique system in the United States. This is unique in the advanced world, where we have basically so much of our welfare state administered through private corporations. And this may have made sense 50 years ago when it first began to grow a lot, but that was in a time when America was on top of the world and American business basically had little foreign competition, when healthcare cost far less and when you had a single breadwinner working 35 years at a major company. But as we all know, that's not the case. That's not the way the world works today. Companies are being killed by rising healthcare costs. People are working, young people work 10 jobs or something like that by the time they're 40. The idea that we are tying employment or tying healthcare to employment for the most sense in most cases, is a dead idea whose time has passed, and I'm going to go a little bit more into the history of that because I know healthcare is of particular interest here in a couple of moments when we go to our next phase. The fourth dead idea is what Stephen Colbert loves so much. Taxes hurt the economy, and they're always too high. Now, why do I say that? Why do I say that's a dead idea? Obviously, in the next 18 months or 2 years, we're going to cut taxes as part of trying to muscle through this recession. But this recession will pass. And once it does pass, there is no question that in the decade afterward, taxes are going to rise no matter who is in political power, because we're retiring the baby boom generation. And when we do, we're going to double the number of double the number of Americans who are on Social Security and Medicare. There are already $50 trillion unfunded promises in those programs today. The math doesn't work at current levels of taxation. Now, the good news is, even though taxes will inevitably go up, once this recession is over, the economy will be fine. And as I tell my conservative friends who worry about the fact that we're going to have to do this and we're going to have to raise taxes, we won't become France or Sweden. We can do what we need to do and still end up being more of a rough, tough cowboy U.S. economy than a cradle-to-grave welfare state like some others that my friends on the left admire. But we should use the fact that taxes will have to rise as the boomers age as an opportunity to tax ourselves more smartly in ways that boost our prosperity. And to me, that means cutting taxes on things like payrolls, which are very regressive. They hurt lower-income people the most, and they kill jobs. And raising taxes on things like dirty energy, which we need to do if we want to meet our environmental goals and cut down on greenhouse gas emissions. So that's the fourth dead idea. The fifth dead idea is what I call schools are a local matter. And by that, I should be clear. I'm all for parental involvement in schools. It's obviously critical. A sense of local ownership in of a school's direction is critical for a school's success. But again, as with healthcare, in the U.S., we're unique in the advanced world in leaving it basically to 15,000 local school districts to basically fund themselves through local property taxes and related state taxes and to set the standards for what kids ought to know. And this made perfect sense in the 19th century when this system got started in the United States. In fact, as I go through the history of these dead ideas, the property tax back in the 19th century was considered a progressive way to fund education because Americans hadn't segregated themselves into thousands of little socioeconomically distinct taxing districts the way we have today. So you had the wealthy family up on the hill and the merchants in the middle and the poor folks or working folks down in the bottom of town. And property was the main form of wealth. Everybody paid into the system and in different ways and shared the same public service. Today, as we know, the property tax basis and the different local state taxes end up effectively dooming millions and millions of poor American children to having the least qualified, least prepared teachers in America and to having the shabbiest school facilities in America when these are kids who need great schools the most. And this is this injustice, this local control and funding, which we usually view as a virtue, actually, I believe, masks one of the greatest injustices in our society, and it's something that didn't get a peep in the last presidential campaign, although President Obama in the current stimulus package is trying to increase the federal role, if you see what he's packing into the stimulus package, to try and have the feds take on some greater role and start a change in that conversation. So that's the fifth dead idea. Then the final dead idea is what I call money follows merit, another one that some people consider controversial. But by this I refer to the idea that basically capitalism, market capitalism, is an economic meritocracy, the idea that basically we end up where we deserve to. And I think that, you can't open the newspaper these days without seeing a banking executive who has walked off with $40 or $50 or $100 million after essentially gutting the bank, costing the jobs of thousands of their employees, and leaving the economy in the tank. When we see stuff like this, and again, I write this book as an ardent capitalist who's trying to update the way we think about American capitalism at this moment in ways that will preserve it and make sure that we can gain its benefits in the era ahead. So I'm not anti-wealth. No one begrudges Steve Jobs or Bill Gates their fabulous wealth when they've created innovations and products and services that have had so much benefit to society. But when we see every day hedge fund managers who make, $100 million when they haven't beat the S&P, when we see CEOs, redoing their offices for $1 million while they're on the federal dole in the banking industry, it's clear that a lot of the wealth at the top is not the result of the rewards to a free market, but it's the result of rigged systems that reward mediocrity as much as they do success. And they reward failure in many cases. And I think that's very corrosive for capitalism. It's corrosive for democracy. We're seeing it play out in the headlines today, and we'll need to get past that dead idea to kind of right the ship and create the kind of sustainable culture where there's opportunity and security, not just for those who benefit from these rigged systems. So that's the last dead idea. Now, remember, we had three steps that I was going through. Identify the dead ideas that matter. And that was the first one, which we just did, these six dead ideas. The second one, I'll just take a minute on it, and these will go quickly, is to understand each dead idea's story. Now, why do I say that? I think that you can't really move past these dead ideas without understanding where they came from and what the source of their power was. So each chapter in the book, in the front section, is basically a mini biography of these dead ideas. How did they get started? Where did the ideas originate? Why did they arguably make sense for a long time when circumstances were different? Then what's changed and what's happened now that makes them arguably dangerous or harmful or perverse, and who's got a stake in their persistence nonetheless? Because the politics of that obviously play a role in moving past them. Let me just illustrate through one of the dead ideas why I think there's real power in looking at the history of these ideas and understanding each dead idea's story as a prelude to moving past them. Your company should take care of you. Again, this is the idea of why we have this employer-based healthcare system. I think that the story that we're usually told by the policy wonks, while true, is somewhat misleading. The basic story we're usually told about how we got to do things this way is that in World War II, there was a wage and price freeze, and benefits were exempt from that. And so companies began to offer benefits as a way to attract and retain employees, and then the federal government came in after the war and ratified that arrangement with a big subsidy, and it grew from there. Now, that's true so far as it goes, but it makes it sound as though our massive corporately administered welfare state, unique in the world, was really the accidental byproduct of wartime pricing policy. I think the more interesting story really dates to the beginning of the 20th century, in the early 1900s, when in the first backlash against the excesses of industrial capitalism, you had people dying in coal mines, huge worker safety issues, sweatshops, unions were beginning to form. In Europe, labor parties were forming and heading down what the U.S. conservative side saw as the slippery slope towards socialism, which many of them followed. And the business community in the U.S. and its conservative political allies decided they needed a strategy to try and keep a lid on this, to try and stop the growth of unions in the state. And the strategy they arrived at, not from, six guys sitting around a table, but the de facto strategy they arrived at, especially for the big companies that could afford this, which were quasi-monopolistic at the time, was to begin to offer different kinds of benefits and to give workers a greater measure of security and benefit that societal expectations were now suggesting ought to be theirs. And this ability to fund these benefits in the pre-war period and then afterward, when we were basically the only economy left standing and our companies were so dominant in the world, basically let corporate America pass on through higher prices the cost of much of America's welfare state. And that worked okay for a while. Again, as we said, when there was a single breadwinner working 35 years at a major company and the family was around them benefiting from those benefits, when healthcare cost 5% of GDP as it did in 1960, not 17% of GDP headed to 20% as it does today. But as we know today, you've got companies like General Motors famously spending more on healthcare than they do on steel. Starbucks spends more on healthcare than they do on coffee. And workers are left in a situation because of the nature of employment and benefits being tied where we've got 50 million uninsured, maybe 30 million additional folks uninsured, and tremendous anxiety. It doesn't work anymore. And when you look at how the system started and evolved, my argument to business leaders who often resist the idea of moving past this system that they're at the center of, even though in one breath they're saying these costs are killing us, in the next breath, they tend to say, if someone says, well, government should pick up some of these costs, many CEOs will say, well, wait a minute, we don't want government involved in this, to which I say, who else do you think is available? And rightly understood, and this is the way I argue it to the business community, the employer-based healthcare system was a vital tool in our long twilight struggle against communism and socialism. But we won that war. That war ended in 1989. And today, notwithstanding the kind of unusual, remarkable interventions we're going to see for a couple of years in the banking system in particular, the real threat is not that America is going to become socialist. That's what the Wall Street Journal editorial page thinks. They're wrong. The real threat is that America is going to become protectionist because there's tremendous legitimate worker anxiety in a global economy where people feel insecure and don't have these kind of basic protections. And so if we can get past this dead idea and put it in its proper historical light by understanding its story, we'll be able to move toward a new vision of how to provide security that I think will put us in better stead. So to close then, after we identify the dead ideas that matter, after we understand each dead idea's story, the last step in this handy-dandy three-step process for unearthing and discarding dead ideas is to reach for new and paradoxical ways of thinking. And what I mean by that is once you've gone through the process of thinking through and seeing where these ideas come from, why they don't make sense, and have a more hard-headed assessment of current realities, I think the trick then for us individually and then as a society is to ask what are the things that are basically destined to replace these ideas, because it's just not sustainable that we operate our country based on premises that no longer fit with the facts. And I try and state them as paradoxes because I think that helps us stretch our minds. They only seem like paradoxes today, I think, because our vision is so skewed. But let me tick them off quickly, and we can, again, go into more of them if you want in Q&A. But here are what I call tomorrow's destined ideas. First, only government can save business. That has to do not just with the banking thing we're seeing today, but with the bigger role in healthcare and pensions that take this burden off of our businesses so they can compete. Second, only business can save liberalism. Now, my more liberal friends say, what do you mean by that? And my point is there is that our healthcare and education sectors are two of the biggest, most important sectors of our economy and society. They are also both radically inefficient. We spend more on healthcare and education, particularly in healthcare, than our wealthy peers, and we get less out of the system. So there's radical inefficiency. Unless we can re-engineer the cost structure of how we deliver healthcare and how we deliver education, and remember, both those sectors are stuck in very old ways of doing things for reasons that we understand, we won't be able to have enough money as the baby boom ages for the other things we think we ought to be doing as a society. So I think it's going to take businesses' entrepreneurial energy and innovation to help us lower costs, to help us do more for less, which is what business does basically in every other area of life. If you look at how your computers change and how your iPods change, your Kindles change, you know, things will keep getting better and cheaper, except in healthcare and education. And there are ways that we can harness market forces to do this, not through some George Bush-like privatization agenda, but I'm talking about things like the MinuteClinics at places like Walmart and Target, where you can go in and get earaches or infections or sore throats or vaccines for $35 or $40 done much quicker, 7 days a week from nurse assistants, instead of having to go to your primary care physician where it would cost more, God forbid the emergency room where it may cost thousands of dollars. So there are ways that we can innovate, and only business can help save liberalism in that sense. Next, only higher taxes can save the economy and the planet. That's the tax change I talked about a little earlier. Only the lower upper class can save us from inequality. And by that, I refer to what I call the lower upper class in the book, those who were watching some of the banking CEOs and others today making off with tremendous loot, not through any connection to merit, and I think who are going to form the constituency for a new progressive agenda that we need. Only better living can save sagging paychecks, because those of us who face wage challenges in this new era will find that there are things outside the pure consumption ethic that gives us satisfaction and meaning in life. Only a dose of nationalization can save local schools, the bigger federal role in standards and finance, as I alluded to. And then finally, only lessons from abroad can save American ideals. And by that, I want to urge us to get past our parochialism as a country. You know, when American businesses that are excellent businesses try and improve their performance, they benchmark themselves against the best in the world, not the best in the San Francisco region, not the best in California, not the best in the West, but against the best in the world. Yet in our public life, if someone says, why don't we look at what Singapore is doing on pensions or what Finland is doing on teacher training, and they're doing very interesting things we could learn from, the typical reaction in Washington, where I spend a fair amount of time, is, well, that may be fine for some small Asian benevolent dictatorship or for some sauna-loving tundra in the north, but we're America, damn it. You know, we don't have anything to learn from them. We'll tell them what to do. Well, that's not working too well in our financial system, as you can see these days, which only, you know, a year or two ago, our officials were flying around the world telling folks to be more like America when it came to finance. And similarly, it's not like we used to be in our own history. You know, we created our university system largely after what we admired in the Germans. We created our governmental institutions, absent the monarchy, largely based on what we thought the Brits had right. So the idea that we need to learn from other countries that today are doing a better job combining growth with equity than we are, and I think that ought to be the goal, is something that will come to the fore. So those are my destined ideas, and happy to talk more about them. I also, some people will ask, you know, if you say that ideas become stale and eventually dead over time, the questions occurred as I've been talking about the book. How do we know these ideas you say are destined won't themselves become dead? Why should we pay attention to them at all right now? And I think it's a fair question, and that's why I'm offering what I think is an unprecedented 10-year warranty on these ideas, so that if any time any of these new ideas is not working for you, you bring it back, and I will fix it, or if I can't fix it, I will replace it with an entirely new idea. So to sum it up, Identify the dead ideas that matter, understand each one's story, and then reach for new and paradoxical ways of thinking. Now, this process is so straightforward, it makes you wonder how we keep getting ourselves trapped in these dead ideas, but I think we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves. The perils of orthodoxy at moments of sudden or pervasive change have been with us forever. The blind spots bred by complacency or arrogance or certitude or habit fill the obituaries of civilizations that didn't make it, businesses that didn't make it, even marriages that didn't make it. It's human nature. And it's the things we think we know but don't that are often the chief obstacle to success in nearly every endeavor. In the end, however, I think the true measure of a person, an organization, or a society is not the dead ideas we fall prey to. It's whether we can summon the perspective and imagination to recognize the dead ideas in our midst and to bury them before real damage or more damage is done. Thank you.
Our thanks to Matt Miller for his comments this afternoon. Matt, terrific. I'm Dan Ashley, anchor of ABC 7 News at 5, 6, 9, and 11 p.m. I'll be conducting the audience question portion of the program today. We have a number of questions I know from this audience. I'll begin with a few that spring to my mind. Matt, very provocative book and discussion. Thank you very much. You alluded to it there at the end of your remarks, one of my favorite quotations, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but the gist is similar to what you said. It's not, and I can't remember who said it, it's not what you don't know that gets you in trouble, but what you know for sure that just ain't so. It seems to me, as you tick off the six identified dead ideas, many of them go to the fundamental heart of what we tend to think of ourselves as Americans. I would imagine, from a political standpoint, that's a very tough sell to address. I have a hard time imagining, it's one thing for an author to do it and a journalist to do it, I have a hard time imagining a candidate for office telling voters that perhaps our kids will not earn more than we do and we should not think that that's a big deal. How do you change? That's a significant culture shift. Several of these core ideas that you talk about really are fundamentally different from our notion of ourselves as Americans. How do we address that?
It's a great point, here's how I think about that. At the end of the book, I have a chapter that I call From Dead to Destined Ideas, which is how are we going to get from here to there. And I think one way we will not get to it is through a deep, honest, open conversation about these ideas in political campaigns. And when I was a younger man, that used to bother me. When I was younger, and I've worked in the Clinton White House, so I've been around politics and understand the challenges and difficulties of all this. And when I was younger and more naive, I guess, I used to think there really ought to be some connection between campaigning and governing. Now, that was my naive younger self.
That is naive, isn't it?
Now I've come to this, what I think is a mature view, which is that, and when you're around politics enough or worked in the White House as I did and talked to political professionals all the time, politicians will those who advise them will tell you that a political campaign is not the time to try and change people's minds about something they believe strongly. It's a time to show how your values and your persona fit with what they already believe. But that's not inconsistent in our history with these changes taking place. I mean, FDR in 1932 campaigned vigorously against Herbert Hoover's awful budget deficits and pledged that he would do whatever it took to balance budgets. And then he turned around and immediately became the original Keynesian deficit spender in ways that we're now building on. Now, does that mean that that FDR was lying somehow during the campaign? I prefer to think the answer is no. I think that what our politicians do when they're good practice what I would think of as responsible demagoguery. And I realize it's hard to tell the difference between the responsible kind and the irresponsible kind. And that's really why democracy ends up being an act of faith so often. But another example I cite in the book was Governor Schwarzenegger. If you remember his last campaign against poor Phil Angelides, who was trounced, the heart of Arnold's campaign was he's going to raise taxes, and he's going to do that. And I won't. And he's going to do it for some harebrained liberal scheme like universal health care. Well, what did Arnold do a couple months after he won his landslide reelection? He essentially proposed to raise taxes for a harebrained scheme like universal health care. And I applaud him for that. So there's just a difference between the way politicians who want to lead win power. That's just a reality. And it doesn't mean that if we don't get the right ideas in the heads of those who would lead us, that we can't still find our way to these ideas taking hold.
Clearly a long process, however, this kind of fundamental change.
Well, crisis accelerates things like that. I think we're in a moment now where Obama himself is somebody who gets this and is open to new ideas, and crisis provides a chance to begin to change the nature of the conversation.
For example, item number 6, money follows merit. I think that notion, because of what's going on now, our opinions may have accelerated in terms of how we've changed our points of view. How many, you mentioned Sweden and France and some other countries that we can learn from, and someone who talks a great deal about this is Fareed Zakarian, Post-American World, which is a terrific book if you haven't read it. Kind of a two-pronged question. By the way, we love our saunas in Northern California, as an aside. It occurs to me that no one really has ever done this before in history, this giant multicultural society. How many of our challenges are unique to the unique nature of America, our huge size, our huge level of diversity, that some of the other countries that are meeting challenges in different ways don't necessarily have the same sort of demographical, societal, socioeconomic challenges that we do?
Another great question. I think that some of the if you think that, as I do, that some of what this moment means and one major sort of thread that links the dead ideas we've got now and where we need to go is going to be to basically increase the kind of social insurance we have in the United States as the flip side of the open economy. So more security for folks in a fast-changing world than has typically been what the U.S. has done. And, you know, there are people who strongly believe that in some of these other countries that have more robust safety nets, the fact that they're so homogeneous culturally helps build a consensus for that more easily. So I've always believed that our unbelievable diversity is a tremendous strength, but it may be that there are still folks who feel like, why should we all be together helping the other when there are still some barriers? And one of the things I'm most encouraged by is, you know, when I look at my daughter's 11, when I look at the next generation, I think each generation gets more and more seamlessly accustomed to the idea that people are people and we're all Americans. And so I think that augurs well for us being able to revisit some of these assumptions or biases or even prejudices that may have held back some of this evolution.
Okay. Let me put a question from someone in the audience, Matt. California healthcare policy seems to be an incremental process. Do you think incrementalism is or should be a dead process? Why or why not?
In terms of it, it's dead because stop worrying about the incremental. Let's go for the bigger, bolder thing. I'm definitely all in favor of bigger and bolder. Because I think one of the only ways we've got so many ingrained special interests around these debates and around these ideas, and the old joke in healthcare reform is that every constituency, the insurers, the doctors, the health plans come to the table with their plan A for reform that they prefer, but plan B is the status quo, and that's why we keep getting stuck in this quagmire. And so I guess I think bolder is the better way to go. I'm fine on banking incremental things where you can get them to help people where you can, but I certainly want folks like our president to be aiming very big and setting down the goals and trying to move us towards some kind of American-style universal health coverage in the next few years.
And let me ask you, tomorrow's Destin Ideas ties in a little bit with this and what we were talking about earlier vis-a-vis other countries and lessons we can learn. What lessons can we learn from other countries and other governments, very specifically, that you think would be applicable to us today?
Just a few to toss off. On healthcare, a lot of times there's this, what I think is a canard from the conservative side, which is if we have a bigger government role in healthcare, that means we're going to be socialist, we're going to have a Canadian-style or British-style single-payer system, which I know some people and maybe some people here like. I would prefer to have what I think of as market-based universal health coverage where government assures that we have some kind of basic coverage and essentially subsidizes folks who need help to get a good competing, you know, good family plan from among competing private insurers, and those insurers would be look more like regulated utilities over time, not able to cherry pick people based on health risks. And in Switzerland and Holland, that's exactly the kind of thing they've done. On pensions and teacher training, Singapore has done fascinating things with various forced savings plans that let lower-income folks with matches from the government build up a better nest egg over time. In Finland, they recruit from the top of the college class for their teacher training institutions. And in America, we recruit from the bottom third of the college class. And that's going to have to change if we're serious about having the kind of education for our kids that we pay lip service to, but that in terms of the way we treat the teaching profession today, I think we don't do it all.
Government-sponsored savings plans. I just want to follow up quickly on that. No corporate sponsor.
No, there may be corporate also, but government provides a base level. And there are proposals that have been kicking around in Washington on this, basically from both sides, that would have kind of universal 401ks. And that's not a popular number today, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. I forget what the joke is. People say my 401k is now a 201k, right?
Right.
But where it's not tied to a job, and the government would match people for their savings. So if you save $500 a year, the government might put in, if you're lower income, the government might put in $1,200 if you save $500 and so on up the line as a way to help people get a start in building their own nest egg that complements Social Security and any corporate pension they might get.
Question from the audience, Matt, about education. High school dropout rates are astronomical, as high as 40 or 50% in some school districts. Why isn't this central to any debate on the future economic growth of the country? Education often seems to take a backseat to other issues such as tax policy. In terms of the economic health of the country,
I agree totally with that point of view, and I think the out for because the politics of the education debate can be very thorny. The out for our presidential candidates and our federal candidates is that education's a local issue, so they're always able to say, "Well, sure, we need to do more on this or this," and you know, sing the praises of teaching, blah blah blah. But then they say, "Well, it's primarily a state and local issue." I think that the economic future of the United States obviously depends on the brain power of the rising generation. This has to become a federal issue, and it's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about.
All right. Another question here from the audience that just came in. At many levels of government, decisions seem to be made on the basis of anecdotal evidence and political expediency, neither solid indicators necessarily, and certainly doesn't fall in line sometimes with common sense. How does that change you? You know, we like to think we're a very informed society, but in many respects we're not. There's a lot of information coming at us, much of it not verified, much of it contradictory. How is that going to change in terms of what we expect from our government?
Well, a couple of thoughts. I do think with the new administration we have a group that is more committed to fact-based analysis and science than in the previous one, and I don't mean that as a partisan statement. I think people like Paul O'Neill, for example, the Republican first Treasury Secretary for George Bush, he left in part because he was frustrated because he found it such a fact-free environment. So it was just the crop of leaders in that administration, I think, had more interest in plowing ahead regardless of the facts. But, you know, it's something for the media, something that the media has to do, too. And I realize this is a time of tremendous strain in the media where people are worried about, you know, what newspaper is going to close and how media institutions are going to thrive or evolve to whatever the next, you know, their final or evolving incarnation on the web is going to be. But I think there's a tremendous role for the media to hold government accountable by providing those kind of facts and making sure we're informed.
Let me ask sort of a broader question, if I may, Matt, about this moment in time is so unique. You know, we hear every day from the news media, from our political figures that we're experiencing an economic upheaval and turmoil like we have not seen in our lifetimes, which is certainly true. As you suggest, and I certainly believe as well, this will pass, not without some significant damage perhaps, but this will pass. Where are we, in your judgment, in a moment of time? You know, great moments of change and upheaval come at times like this. Profound change happens in a society at critical moments.
Right.
Often when we're chugging along, we don't change. There's no reason to. Where do you think we are in American history? Are we really at such an important tipping point, like, again, to go back to Zakaria's book, that where other countries that used to really resent the United States are now indifferent toward us to some degree, mm-hmm. because they have emerged, they have their own economies moving strongly. Where are we now?
I think we're not in anything, even though we keep getting told every day by our leaders that this is the worst crisis since the Great Depression, which can, you know, take its toll after a while on your cheery disposition. but we're not. I mean, we're not in anything like that, even though this is an unbelievable financial meltdown that hasn't happened since then. You know, in 1932 and 33, there was 25% unemployment. I mean, I'm reading now, there's a great new book by Adam Cohen called Nothing to Fear, about the first 100 days and the five key advisors around FDR. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan Alter had a similar great book called The Defining Moment. And when you look back at, or there may be folks here who have lived through part of that history, I mean, people were destitute in the streets. There were, riots and food riots. And we are not in that situation today, thank goodness. I don't think we'll get to anything like that. But the drama of that awfulness did help make it possible for some of the changes that happened then. I think what this crisis has done is jolt us into realizing whatever we're doing, something's wrong, and has created a kind of openness among the American people. And I think some of these deeper forces, which are the rise of China and India and the fact that we're like a business now. You know, there are a lot of businesses. I have a consulting life as opposed to my public policy life. And so many businesses end up being who operate without competition for a long time or are so dominant for a long time, suddenly hit the wall when, because of technological change or new market entrants, they suddenly face real competition. And boom, they find out that the way they've been doing things, they've got just a lot of things screwed up and are inefficient and don't make sense, and the old ways of doing things don't make sense. I think we're at the sort of early to middle part of realizing that because we're not going to be the totally dominant economy in the world anymore, which is a great thing for the world. You know, hundreds of millions of people are coming out of poverty all over the world. It's going to force us to rethink these things, but it's going to take a decade or so for us to proceed through this. And I think this current financial crisis, which is a separate thing really from that, is going to accelerate that.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Matt Miller about potential solutions to a healthcare crisis. He is the author of a new book, The Tyranny of Dead Ideas. Dan Ashley of ABC 7 News. Matt, the dead ideas, is there a chance that perhaps these ideas, well, and to some degree maybe outmoded a little bit, but maybe aren't dead? We shouldn't talk, in the words of Stephen Colbert, maybe we should hang on to them for their sense of tradition, but rework them a little bit. Do they need to be tossed out?
Well, there's one I don't want to toss out, which is, you know, the idea that the kids will learn more than we do.
You don't want to tell your 11-year-old daughter that.
Right, that she can't have a better life than daddy. And I don't think, obviously, we don't want that for our kids. And I think there is a good chance, and obviously I state it provocatively as a way of trying to wake us up on this, but I do think that we're in a situation like Britain in the 1880s or 1890s was talked about back then as being a country in decline because the U.S. was rising up, other countries were rising up. It's somewhat analogous to what we're seeing now with the rest of the world. And, you know, even though Britain may have been in relative decline from the 1890s, British living standards rose enormously in the next 100 years. People today are obviously much, much wealthier in the U.K. than they were 100 years ago. And I think, but at the same time, during those first few decades of adjustment, a lot of families were affected. And so I think that the broad upward earnings escalator can resume, but I think we're in a transition where we need to think a lot about how we're all in the same boat and how to make sure that we have a certain level of opportunity and security for those who are affected by this economic change during this period, even with our eye on the fact that this idea can come back to life in a powerful way once we've made this kind of one-time historical adjustment.
So that's the one dead idea you would like to hang on to.
Yes. It'd be great if taxes – I don't want taxes to go up. When I say taxes are going up, but there's just no other – unless we think we can borrow, you know, everything from China to pay for our own baby boomers' retirement, and I think we're going to find out in the next couple of years already we're going to stretch the limits of how much federal debt we can peddle or should peddle. Some of these things are a bit baked into the – cake at this point.
On taxes, here's a provocative question from someone in the audience. Can health care reform occur while so much wealth is increasingly held in the hands of the top 1%, 2%, 3%, or 4%. And let me broaden that beyond just health care. Society reform, although, you know, people will tell you that the top 1 or 2% pay 50% of the income tax in the country or whatever the figure is. Speak to that question, if you will. Such a small percentage of the population holds such a large percentage of the wealth.
I appreciate that you said that it's the top few percent that pay the bulk of income taxes, because many people who make that argument, as you know, don't right. refer only to income taxes. And
sure.
if you look at all our taxes, it's a slightly progressive system, not the way it is just with income taxes. But can we surmount the plutocracy and take control of our futures? I guess I think the answer is yes. I'm optimistic about that. Obviously, there's a group at the top that does very well, but there's still a fair amount of circulation into that group in every generation. There's new entrepreneurs who create these new businesses and become part of the financial elite. And I guess I think that I don't think in the U.S., I don't believe in the kind of conspiracy theory some have that basically think there's just a handful of wealthy people who basically run the country. I don't believe that. And I think that what I call the lower upper class in the book, which is the group below that, who's the doctors and lawyers, the professionals, the vice presidents of marketing, but not the CEO, those are several million people. They're TV anchors, they're journalists, they're editors of major newspapers, very influential segment of society. And I have a lot of hope that they, with business leaders, once they're woken up, can help us make the adjustments that we need in the decade ahead.
I'm just doing this until I can become a captain of industry.
It's a stepping stone.
It's a stepping stone, yes. I will soon control the world. Here's an interesting question. And, you know, I've actually written a lot about this. And we're seeing it today. And a lot of people I run into, Matt, and the same way, I think, in the last week or two, watching what's happening in Washington, there was so much optimism with the new administration and things are going to move. And yet we seem to have some partisan gridlock. That is democracy in action, of course. That's supposed to happen. But this question from a member of the audience speaks to that a little bit. How do you suggest we reach a place where the politicians get on board with the changes we need? And while we still seem to see politics as usual in Washington, even in a great moment of crisis such as this? The discourse is still a little angry.
Yes. A couple of thoughts. Just on your first point, it's funny because things move so quickly now in the news that I thought this would happen, but I couldn't believe in the Financial Times on the plane up that there was already a column talking about the failed Obama administration already after, what is it, two weeks old?
He's had a good solid 2 weeks.
He's had a shot, and it's over. I think in a democracy we get the government we deserve. And so it's never enough to just blame our leaders for, behaving in the old ways, because I think politicians will scramble to lead any parade that forms. And the trick in democracy is to organize the right parades. And all of us have a responsibility and a duty to make the world safe for them to think outside the box. I do think. And I think Obama's taken tremendous criticism on the left from this already, that Obama has tried very hard, even if he's not getting a lot of Republican votes yet. He has been courting them. He went to speak to their caucus. It's only been 2 weeks, remember. He went to speak to the House and Senate Republican caucuses alone. You know, there are a lot of Democratic interest groups who he hasn't gone and visited alone since he's been president. He has asked for their input. He's having these, events at the White House. They may have once a week where they're having people over for drinks and stuff. And that's not, people poo-poo that. But in Washington, people used to socialize. When you talk to legislators from the 60s, people used to socialize and have real friendships across the aisle, which is important for actually getting things done. And that's been lost in the last 20 years or so. And I think he's trying to set a different tone. He's paying a price with his own base for doing that. But I think that that's really in his blood. You could see that at his press conference the other night. And I think I hope he's going to make headway on that.
All right. Very quickly, if I can, Matt, because I want to get in one last question. We're almost out of time. Interesting from the audience, and I don't know if your research dealt with this, but when in history have civilizations let go of their dead ideas and survived? Has it ever happened? Is it even possible?
I think the answer is yes. And when you talk about when I was talking about some of the old things in our own history, and those were dramatic examples like slavery and suffrage, et cetera. But I mean, that's the great thing in America, at least. The great thing is our American history is this long arc of a battle to realize the ideals in our founding documents. It's always imperfect, but we keep making progress in every generation, in large part because there's new efforts to get rid of old ideas that don't make sense anymore and to replace them with better ways of thinking that suit our community in a different era. So I am very hopeful. This doesn't mean this isn't like the Jared Diamond book or other things where civilizations become extinct because we can't get a handle on these things. I'm very optimistic. It's just a matter of changing our minds and then figuring out how together to change our minds together.
What a nice place to end. Our thanks to Matt Miller, contributing editor to Fortune Magazine, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and the author of The 2% Solution and the new book we've been discussing today, The Tyranny of Dead Ideas. Thank you to Matt Miller. We thank our audience here and on the radio. This program has been generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. I'm Dan Ashley of ABC 7 News, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Great job. Great. You were great.